In 10 seconds, the National Broadcasting Company presents a special broadcast from Operation Crossroads. We take you now to the NBC newsroom in San Francisco.
This is the Pacific Story. However, tonight's Pacific Story will be different from any ever heard. The National Broadcasting Company this evening brings you a first-hand account of the most important thing that happened in the Pacific today. Yes, the most important thing that happened in the world today. The dropping of the atomic bomb at Bikini Atoll. The dropping of this atomic bomb was an experiment of a kind and on a scale never before attempted by mankind. For months, NBC has been laying plans to bring you this broadcast directly from the scene of the great explosion. NBC newscasters and correspondents, long experienced in reporting the world's great events, have been on hand at Bikini for weeks. And now you can hear for yourself, directly from them, what happened when the bomb went off over the target ships in Bikini Atoll. We take you now to NBC in the Pacific.
This is Ralph Howard Peterson speaking from the flying bridge of the flagship Mount McKinley. We are now marking time in the entrance to Bikini Lagoon, just about 2 miles from the target array. We are still a good distance from the Navy vessels that a few hours ago took the first of an atomic bomb, and, if I may add, took it pretty well.
Our first battle has been a slow and cautious one,
like a young lady entering cold water. A number of times we were almost into the lagoon, but then we stopped and wheeled about. As I talk to you now, a number of ships are going into the lagoon, and very shortly we too will round it.
From a distance, the target array looks virtually untouched.
You still get the impression of a task force awaiting orders to sail. The various type ships present a picture of naval strength from a distance of 4 or 6 miles. It is only when you get close that you begin to realize that the atomic bomb raised havoc among the target ships. For example, the Navy transports Carlisle and Gillam have been sunk. The destroyer Lampson capsized. Heavy damage was inflicted on the submarine Skate. The carrier Independence, but seems to have lost most of its island and is now leaning against the stern of the Japanese battleship Nagato. Strands of smoke still come from her deck. The German cruiser Prince Oregon is also heavily damaged. This announcement by Crossroad officials came as a surprise to me, because from a distance, the Prince Oregon looked untouched. She was fairly far from the bullseye ship Nevada, so her damage apparently is in the superstructure. The Japanese cruiser Sakawa also suffered heavy damage. A number of other ships suffered light to negligible damage. These were the Pensacola, the Nagato, the Nevada, and 2 smaller vessels. The fact that the Nevada suffered only light damage, at least according to first aerial reports, indicates that the bomb did not explode directly over the bullseye. There is every indication that the bomb exploded to the left of the Nevada. But just how far to the left or port side, we'll probably never know. That is classified and secret material. Immediately after the bomb burst, we aboard the Mount McKinley, 11 miles from the Nevada and 8.25 miles from Bikini Island, were amazed to see so many ships standing. At first, there was no smoke, and despite the huge peach-colored column of radioactive cloud plunging up into the stratosphere, you wondered if the atomic bomb had done any damage. A few minutes later, however, the first signs that the atom bomb had wrecked damage in the target fleet became apparent. Black and gray smoke began to rise from the number of vessels in the center of the array. These fires were on the destroyer Wilson, the Sakawa, the Nevada, the Saratoga, and the transport Briscoe. By that time, the Mount McKinley was moving slowly toward the lagoon. But I know of no one who actually saw flames. However, perhaps if I looked long enough aboard ship, I might find someone who would swear they saw flames. You know, that's a funny thing about this atomic explosion. Everyone seems to have experienced a different sensation. Some say they felt the heat and pressure waves. Others say they felt the heat, but didn't notice the pressure wave. Upon one thing, everyone seems in agreement. And that is, it was an eternity between the time the bombardier called bomb away and the instant the bomb exploded. It's hard to tell from this distance at the moment, but apparently the atomic blast did not affect the island of Bikini. As we passed on the ocean side of the island a while ago, I could see the basketball standard still standing in the recreation area. All the towers in Bikini and Ayman Island are standing, and there is no sign that any large waves have washed up on the beaches. Here in the flagship McKinley, there's a regular holiday spirit this afternoon. Work is going forward, messages are being dispatched, orders are being given. But there's a definite lessening of the nervous tension that has hung over this center of Operation Crossroads for the past 10 days. And now, I switch you to George Thomas Foster, aboard the press ship USS Appalachia.
This is George Thomas Foster reporting from the radio ship, the Appalachian. These things are happening so fast now, but it doesn't pay to make notes. I've just come down from the radar towers of this ship. And even as I climbed down out of the rigging, an announcement came over the ship's loudspeaker that changed all my notes. Over an hour or so, the ship's loudspeaker bellows forth a new estimate of damage, or rather a report of damage as it looks from where we sit. But I figure that this is a time to take it easy. I mean insofar as estimating how much damage. There are people here on board who are going around with long faces.
We're sorry that broadcast conditions do not permit our continuing with George Thomas Foster. We take on over now to W.W. Chaplin.
This is W.W. Chaplin on the Army radio ship Spindelion, Kwajalein Lagoon. The great atom bomb trial of naval vessels at Bikini is completed, but the jury is still out as to the verdict. The bomb was dropped from great height at 9:04 this Monday morning, 6 p.m. Sunday, New York time, and it exploded above the anchored unmanned fleet in the Bikini Lagoon. As to what happened then, you can get almost any answer you like. Most of the Army and Navy participants or observers I've talked to have felt that the damage was not nearly as great as expected. It was certainly, they say, no Pearl Harbor. And airmen in bomber and observation planes said the shockwave wasn't as bad as weather bumps that they had experienced over the hump between India and China. Scientists, on the other hand, felt differently. Dr. Roger Warner, head of the Los Alamos scientists here, who was forced to give his seat in the bomber almost at the last moment for a priority newcomer, he told me that he thought, from second-hand reports, that the blast was every bit as powerful as those in New Mexico and Japan. With me in the studio here is Lieutenant Colonel John Moynihan, a member of Admiral Blandy's staff and formerly attached to the Manhattan District, which made the bomb. He is also author of the brand-new book, Atomic Diary. So he's really got a cross-section military scientist viewpoint. And he was on the radio plane that accompanied the bomber. John, will you give us a quick picture of the damage that you actually saw?
Bill, I suppose hundreds of thousands of words have already been said and written about today's fantastic spectacle. As far as the actual damage goes, there's only one thing which I must say. We already hear early reports of sinking ships and fires and relative strengths and all manner of speculative things. But let us wait for the evaluation boards to sift out the monumental data, which I know was recorded today. Then we can get our result properly adjusted. Today, when we were high above that make-believe fleet down below, the whole picture seemed entirely unreal. For months we had been pointing for this. Operation Crossroads now has completed one of its three scheduled bomb bursts. This is a cold fact. But today's mission is but a milestone in the infant stages of the atomic age. My sincerest hope that this will be the milestone to broader understanding, which, after all, Bill, is the only lasting block to the use again of this unendurable weapon in warfare.
That certainly sounds very sensible, John. Now, there's a couple of things that I'd like to ask you about. If you were out there in a plane very close to the area where the bomb detonated, and there are some things that we here haven't been able to find out. For instance, exactly what did that cloud look like? That cloud that came up after the bomb, from where you were?
Well, Bill, when the detonation came, I was staring into the inky darkness of my blackout goggles, which defied even the bright tropical day. And then there was an interminable wait from the time between the bomb away, which we heard in our earphones, and then the actual flash. It was the most intense and dramatic moment of the entire experiment. I counted a quick 10 and ripped off my glasses. And there it was, unfolding before us, and we really had a ringside seat.
Thank you very much, Colonel John Moynihan. This is W.W. Chaplin at Kwajalein, switching you now to George Thomas Foster on the Appalachian.
We're now back on board the Appalachian, and you will now hear Mr. David Dietz, science editor of the Scripps Howard Papers and author of the popular book, Atomic Energy in the Coming Era. Mr. David Dietz.
This is David Dietz speaking from the USS Appalachian. We are now circling within sight of the white beach and green palms of Bikini Island, awaiting the order to re-enter the lagoon, along with Admiral Brandy's flagship, the Mount McKinley. Earlier today, you heard NBC correspondents describe the detonation of the atomic bomb. I thought you might be interested in some scientific comments from me. At the time of the explosion, we were approximately 20 miles from the bomb. The atomic bomb appears to have behaved as the scientists expected it would. There were no tidal waves and no earthquakes. The fact that the atomic cloud did not rise as high as the one at Nagasaki, and the fact that it seemed to possess less power, may have been due to the fact that this bomb exploded over water. Instead of picking up vast clouds of dust, it only picked up steam from the surface of the lagoon. The detonation of the bomb was heralded by the expected piercing flash of light. This light is the byproduct of the heat of the explosion. When the charge of plutonium in the bomb undergoes nuclear fission, a temperature of 100 million degrees is generated. Immediately after the flash of light, a ball of fire began to rise and expand, reaching a diameter that seemed to be about 3 miles. This ball of fire was composed of the fragments of the original plutonium, plus a vast amount of air which was heated to incandescence by the tremendous temperature. It rose in the air because of its heat. But almost at once, its great energy began to create a vast turbulence of the air. Within a matter of seconds, the ball of fire was transformed into the atomic bomb cloud. This rose into the sky as a great pillar of luminous cloud, climbing at the rate of about 1,500 feet per minute. The atomic bomb cloud rises for the same reason that smoke goes up the chimney. It rises because it is hot. The height to which it rises, however, is a testimony of how hot it is. Further energy is contributed to the cloud by the radioactivity of the fission fragments in it. 8 minutes after the detonation, the atomic cloud had towered up to a height of 23,100 feet. At this time, it was about 11,000 feet in diameter. Soon, the top of the pillar of cloud began to broaden out into a huge crown or mushroom effect. This mushroom was a luminous, creamy white, streaked with pastel shades of pink and salmon and apricot. Gazing at its beauty, one almost forgot its lethal nature. While this mushroom cloud is spectacular, its explanation is simple. No doubt on a summer day, you have seen a great thunder cloud that towered up into the sky. A wind at high level began to blow off the top of the cloud into a broad sheet, giving the whole thing the appearance of an anvil. Indeed, meteorologists refer to such a cloud as an anvil cloud. In exactly the same fashion, winds in the stratosphere caused the top of the atomic bomb pillar of cloud to begin to broaden into a sheet. And this sheet formed the mushroom. As we watched the mushroom broaden and drift off to the southwest, I am greatly relieved that the meteorologists had been correct in predicting the proper wind. Because if the cloud had not moved in the predicted direction, the end might have been disaster. But fortunately, as Admiral Brandy told you earlier this morning,
Everything went off according to plan, and the crowd moved away without damage.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Deep.
Now, while we're here aboard the Appalachian, I want you to meet a new friend of mine.
Yeah?
You've been hearing from scientists, and you've been hearing from all types of experts. I have corralled Seaman First Class John A. Wheel of New York City. I want him to tell us what he saw today and what he thinks of the New York, of the atomic bomb. But first of all, John, are you really from New York City?
Well, not really. I was born in Montgomery, Alabama.
I knew it. I knew it. That's what I want to establish, because when that voice comes on, I want the people to know. Now tell us, John, where were you when the atomic bomb went off this morning?
Well, George, I was up in the radar tower watching from practically the highest point on the ship next to the crow's nest.
Well, you were up there somewhere where I was.
Exactly.
Okay, and did you wear your glasses when the bomb went off?
Yes, I wore sunglasses before, goggles during, and looked through binoculars.
Now, I understand that some of the boys aboard ship, some of the your shipmates, couldn't get glasses, and that they looked right into the bomb blast without their goggles on. Have you heard that?
Well, most of the boys who didn't have goggles didn't look at the blast. They covered their eyes with their arms and looked down at the deck.
Then you actually don't know of any fellows on board here who looked at the blast without goggles or covering their eyes?
No, I haven't questioned them
on that. Well, what did you think of the blast? Was it up to what you expected or more?
Well, the blast itself was quite what I expected, but I'm a little disappointed in the fact that we were 20 miles away. Perhaps during the next test, we can be closer and therefore get more of a thrill.
Well, all right, if you're looking for thrills, we're getting first in nervous. And Sandy, we have a little while left here. What are you looking forward to? You're a youngster.
How old are you, by the way, John? I'll be 19 this month.
You're 19. Well, you saw your first atomic bomb go off today. Now, what are you looking forward to in your future as far as atomic energy is concerned? Any ideas on that?
Well, I have just one hope on that, and that is that this Operation Crossroads project will be the last wartime war demonstration of the bomb. That is, that in the future it can be used only for peace and science and medicine.
Thank you very much, John Wheel of New York City, and I hope everything that you wish comes true. And we have right here beside us Mr. Bill Lawrence, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner for scientific writings, and now on the staff of the New York Times, and here is Bill to give you his opinion on the atomic bomb. Go ahead, Bill Lawrence.
Thank you, Judge Foster. This is William L. Lawrence of the New York Times speaking. This is the third atomic bomb I have seen, and I'm therefore more or less in a position to make some comparisons. I feel, however, that these comparisons might do harm in the sense that they might detract our attention from the real problem. In actual physical appearance, the cloud today was smaller than either of the three clouds that have followed the three atomic bombs, the one over New Mexico, and the one over Hiroshima, and the one over Nagasaki. But I think that is relatively unimportant. The atomic bomb is still the most powerful force on Earth. It is still the greatest problem we have facing us. If we hadn't seen the Nagasaki one, which rose to 60,000 feet, it would still be terrifying and awe-inspiring to say that we had something that could rise to a cloud of 26,000 feet or 30,000 feet in the air. It would be misleading, I think, if we say that this bomb failed to sink all the fleet in the lagoon, because this particular test was not designed for that kind of an effect. We shall have to wait for that, for the second test, which will come in about 3 or 4 weeks from now, namely a test in which the bomb will be exploded 18 feet or so underwater, and particularly the test scheduled for next year, and in which an atomic bomb will be exploded several hundred feet or thousand feet under the water. In those tests, you will see much more devastating effects than you saw today. What we should still be thinking, not so much necessarily in terms of the military or naval effect of the bomb, we should think of it as a conscious problem facing the world, and how to stop it being used at all against cities, against men and women, against navies, against air forces. You should remember that all sound that the world has learned to hear, that the atomic bomb is here to stay, are wrong.
You should utilize it for the benefit of mankind.
Thank you, Mr. Bill Lawrence. And now we're going to take you to the Panamint, where two speakers are standing by to give you their impressions from that vessel. Go ahead, Panamint.
6 hours after the atom bomb burst at Bikini, the observers on the Panamint have had a chance to digest their first impressions of the super explosion of a package of plutonium atoms. With me are two of our scientists, so this is my opportunity to get some learned views on today's activities. Let's hear first from Mr. Jack Dement of Fluorescent Laboratories in Portland, Oregon. Jack, you've just come down from the fire control tower with the latest on the appearance of the target array 5 or 6 miles away. What can you tell us?
My latest impression, Mr. Wood, is that the damage is dynamic, a continuing one. Thus, the destroyer Hughes is listing fires. Bursts of flame and smoke are issuing from the Saratoga and the Independence, as well as transport ships. Some ships are slowly sinking. Mats and guns are bent at rakish angles like broken twigs. A few ships are seemingly demolished above deck.
From your observation, Jack, does it look as if the bomb exploded over the bullseye or at the edge of the target array?
From my observations, the bomb seems to have exploded at the edge of the target array.
Well, what was your interest today as an individual and as a scientific observer?
My interest lies with the luminous effects occurring in an atomic explosion and subsequent thereto. Aesthetically, the pastel shades are gorgeous, not harsh and conflicting. Scientifically, they are of very great interest. It is important for us to learn the processes involved, for they will help in our understanding of the forces of nature.
Well, you got a chance with that atomic cloud today, Jack. Now let's talk for a moment with Mr. Ethel von Dyke of RCA Laboratories. As a radio engineer, Mr. von Dyke, I know you're interested in the television pickup of the atom blast. What did the screens on the Panamint show at my tower?
On the Panamint, we had two receivers at each of several locations on the ship. The two receivers had different pictures, one from a camera on Bikini Island, at such a point that a large part of the target fleet was visible. The other picture was of the lagoon beach facing the fleet. This meant that as our tournament was 20 miles away, we still could see inside the lagoon very effectively. Each one of the two pictures was something of interest. For example, while watching the fleet picture a few minutes after the blast, I saw a large fire break out on one of the ships. And it was a half minute or so before people on the Panamint watching through binoculars could see the smoke from this fire. The other picture showing the beach was interesting because the beach was different before and after the blast. A large boat, for example, had been turned around and various objects had been moved by the blast.
Do you think, Mr. von Dyke, that this experiment served as a good operational test then for television?
Well, I think it was a good example of the kind of service which television can do very effectively. It meant that our human eyes from 20 miles away were taken right inside the lagoon so that we were able to see what was going on without being present.
Do you feel that that could be of some importance to television's future?
I think that will be a very important part of television's future, and that there will be many cases like it in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Arthur von Dyke and Mr. Jack Dement, for the scientific viewpoint. I switch you to W.W. Chaplin on Kwajalein Island.
On the Army radio ship Spindley in Kwajalein Harbor. The full results of the atom bomb test at Bikini won't be known for months, even years. But one thing we who are here for the Crossroads Project know full well. The atom bomb furnished a day of drama, of melodrama, such as the war itself seldom produced. The first tense moment of the day came at dawn, when the bomb plane took off after a mass evacuation of non-essential personnel from our island.
We who were left here had no liking for that bomb as a close neighbor. We'd been living with it for 2 weeks. And the 25-second run down the airstrip for the takeoff was a strain we'll not soon forget. The plane took off without mishap, and we breathed again. Then came the radio reports from a plane in the air close to Bikini from ships in the near vicinity. At last, the sound of the bomb itself. Then we ran breathless from our below-decks broadcast studio to the main deck and saw the bomb cloud. We had hardly hoped for that, to see a column of deadly vapor rising into the sky more than 200 miles away. But there it was. In the far blue sky, from over the curve of the world, a great white pillar shot upward, spread out, divided into two white heads, and then gradually rode away on the prevailing trade winds from the east. After that, even damage reports seemed anticlimax, despite the fact that they are becoming more serious as the hours go on. From Kwajalein, we who had sent the atom bomb to Bikini, from Kwajalein, we saw the dreaded radioactive cloud mount the sky and ride away. We saw the atom bomb test start and end. This is W.W. Chaplin on Kwajalein, switching you to Ralph Howard Peterson on the Mount McKinley.
Again, speaking from the flying bridge of the flagship Mount McKinley. A few moments ago when I spoke to you, there were only a few strands of smoke rising from the target array. But now, something has really started to burn. It appears to be aboard the Independence. Yes, I've just been informed that it is the Independence. A moment ago, we could actually see red flames with the naked eye. Right now, the smoke is around and it's growing back. A few moments ago, a number of fire tugs were playing streams of water on several other smoking ships. Now they appear to have been all around the Independence, controlling the aircraft carrier. On the Independence. They are on the deck. Many airplanes, army vehicles, gas tanks. There's probably some of these in front of the bar. To the north of us is a rain cloud coming up. Perhaps that will help the fire tugs try to put out the fire. Also at this moment, we're moving into the lagoon. We've gotten upstream and are now sailing in. Apparently, Admiral Blandy wants to see the damage from close up and is going in to see the Independence, which is now afire. The smoke has changed from gray to black and is also increasing. Another ship nearby is also beginning to smoke. I return you now to NBC in the United States.
Was the atom bomb blast an explosion? Was it really a blast? We have asked ourselves that question since radio broadcast from Bikini brought us our first sound of the bomb. It is described as not an explosion of the sort induced by dynamite, but rather as a boiling disturbance of the atmosphere. We have recorded the sound of that disturbance at the time of the drop into the lagoon, so that you'll have an opportunity to decide for yourself just what occurred when the atom bomb was detonated today. We now bring you the recording of the bomb's blast at Bikini. Atom bomb. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to a first-hand broadcast by NBC reporters and correspondents directly from Bikini Atoll in the Pacific, where the atomic bomb was exploded this afternoon. Those who participated in the broadcast from Bikini were Ralph Howard Peterson, George Thomas Folster, W.W. Chaplin, Lieutenant Commander Bill Wood, Mr. Jack DeMint of the Fluorescent Laboratories, Portland, Oregon, Mr. Arthur Van Dyke, Assistant to the Vice President of RCA Laboratories, William E. Lawrence of the New York Times, and David Dietz, science editor of the Scripps Howard newspapers. The Pacific Story, which has been this evening the story of the dropping of the atomic bomb this afternoon at Bikini, came to you from Bikini and from San Francisco. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.